In the coming week, Jordan's King Abdullah visits the White House. Benjamin Netanyahu's trial on bribery charges resumes in Jerusalem, and world leaders convene virtually for an emergency APEC meeting. It's July 15th, 2021, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Jim Linzak.
And I'm Stephen Cook, sitting in for Bob McMahon.
Stephen is CFR's ENI Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies. Stephen, it's a pleasure to have you back on The World Next Week.
Always great to be back. Thanks, Jim.
So let's begin by talking about a country you know a lot about, Jordan. Next week, President Biden will host King Abdullah at the White House. Abdullah is on a three-week tour of the United States, and he will be the first Middle East leader to sit down with President Biden at the White House. What issues do you expect will be topping the agenda for these talks, Stephen?
It's really an interesting visit for King Abdullah. I should say he's here for 3 weeks. It's a long time. From what I understand at the moment, he is on a motorcycle tour of New England. He's an avid motorcycle enthusiast, and he does this quite often.
Do you know what kind of motorcycle he drives or rides?
I think it's a Harley. My understanding, he has a number of them.
Okay, I'm sure he can afford it.
And King Abdullah is, you know, one of those Middle Eastern leaders who feels very comfortable in the American cultural milieu because he went to actually high school here in the United States. And I think that's where he developed his yen for motorcycle touring and Harleys. Anyway, when he gets down to business and visits President Biden in Washington, I think that there's going to be really two main issues on the agenda. The first is, let me just say three items on the agenda. First, just by dint of the fact that he's the first Arab leader to visit with President Biden, kind of elevates Jordan once again. During the Trump years, the relationship between the United States and Jordan sort of withered. Trump was much more interested in Saudi Arabia and some of the other Gulf states. And the president is welcoming Jordan, a longtime and very important ally of the United States in the region. And so I think it, you know, just at the level of optics, it is reinvigorating the relationship.
So you don't think it's an accident or a coincidence that he's the first Arab head of state to be invited to the White House?
Not at all. Not at all. Of course, you know, we have the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, who is essentially persona non grata in the White House, but Washington.
You're talking
generally
Mohammed bin Salman.
Mohammed bin Salman. There have been a number of phone calls between President Biden and the Egyptian President Abdel Fattah Sisi around the violence in Gaza in May, but King Abdullah is getting the first in the White House treatment, and I think it suggests how much importance President Biden attaches to the U.S.-Jordan relationship. So I think there'll be that, and there'll be obviously a discussion of the recent violence in Gaza and reinforcing American support for Jordan and Jordan's position with regard to peace and the Palestinian issue, and importantly, Jordan's official role as the custodian of the Muslim shrines in Jerusalem. This is by dint of the Israel-Jordan peace treaty. Now, historically, of course, the Hashemites were the custodians of the Muslim and Christian sites in Jerusalem. But by dint of the 1994 peace treaty between Israel and Jordan, Israel specifically recognized Jordan's role as the custodian of the Muslim shrines, the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. And in fact, the Jordanians also signed an agreement with the Palestinians in 2013, respecting Jordan's role in Jerusalem as well. So there'll be discussion of the kind of the peace process, Jerusalem, recent violence in Gaza. They'll also discuss aid to Jordan. Jordan is one of the top recipients of aid from the United States. A five-year, $6.4 billion package is coming to an end in 2022, and the king is looking to extend that aid to Jordan. And Jordan needs it. It's been a rough year or more for Jordan. Early on in the pandemic, the Jordanians were very good in containing the pandemic, but it took a massive hit economically, and Jordan has long had a fragile economy. In the first quarter of, I believe it was 2020, 25% of Jordanians were out of work and 50% of young Jordanians were out of work. The Jordanians really do need the assistance from the United States to get through this period. So I expect that the president will agree to that, and I also expect that the Congress will not have a problem with extending the aid to Jordan. If you remember back to the last few election cycles, anytime the Middle East came up among presidential candidates, King Abdullah of Jordan was held out as sort of the model.
He's a fan favorite.
He is definitely a fan favorite of politicians on both sides of the aisle. I should say there is bipartisan support for Jordan in the United States. I'd say the Trump administration was an outlier in letting the relationship with Jordan wither.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the position that King Abdullah is in at home. You mentioned an economy that's in tough times. There is the issue of COVID. But several months ago, story broke that there was some suspicion that elements of his family, his half-brother, were looking to lead a coup effort. They were doing so in conjunction with unnamed foreign governments, never really clearly specified publicly who those people were. So how is the position of the king at home? Also, given the fact that there is a cleavage in Jordanian society, as you know, Stephen, between Berber tribes and Palestinians who moved into Jordan after 1948.
So, as I said, it's been a tough year for Jordan. And in April, the Jordanian authorities uncovered a plot and have subsequently accused 20 people of sedition. This did not include the former Crown Prince Hamza, who is now just Prince Hamza, although at the time, it was clear that Prince Hamza was deeply involved in this plot, whatever it was. It was rolled up, and people have been indicted and are being tried for this. The unnamed foreign sources were, you know, some suggested that there was Israeli involvement. My understanding is that the Israelis immediately contacted King Abdullah and said, this was not us. We have no interest in instability in Jordan, and we are fully supportive of you. The other obvious suspect, for lack of a better term, was Saudi Arabia. And that's because in the previous number of years, there had been rumors of plots against King Abdullah and that they were connected to the Saudis. There was never any real hard evidence of this, but there were suspicions that the Saudis were not happy with King Abdullah and would like to see him go. The other obvious problem and an issue that is at the heart of the balancing act that King Abdullah and before him, his father, King Hussein, had to manage in Jordan is the fact that the Jordanian population is 60%+ Palestinian. And what happens in the West Bank and Jerusalem has an impact on politics in Jordan. King Abdullah's wife, Queen Rania, is of Palestinian origin as well. And there have been differences between the Palestinian population in which there have been government officials, as well as business leaders, as well as a large refugee population, and tribes of the East Bank of the Jordan River who have long been regarded as, you know, the pillars of support for the Hashemite family that rules Jordan. It's the official title is the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. They trace their roots actually to Saudi Arabia and the Hejaz, where Mecca and Medina are. They were run out of that area of Saudi Arabia, and the British helped create.
Well, but who were they run out of that area of Saudi Arabia by?
By the House of Saud. And of course, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is a descendant of the King of Saudi Arabia. It's his grandson. So there are all kinds of differences and problems. And as I said, a balancing act for Jordanian rulers.
So there's a history here.
There is a history here. And from what I understand, among the tribes of the East Bank, they have been rubbed the wrong way by allegations of corruption, by favoritism towards Palestinians, and those kinds of things. Whether those are manufactured allegations by folks who are opposed to King Abdullah is very unclear. But we do know that his father had to engage in this very, very delicate negotiations with those tribes as well as the large Palestinian population. And one of the things that has been a problem for King Abdullah is that he is not as adept with those pillars of support amongst East Bank tribes as his father was. And so it's been a little bit more difficult for him to manage these challenges. But thus far, he remains in place. And I think that the Biden administration welcoming him as the first Arab leader is reinforcing the importance of Jordan and Jordanian stability to the United States, which would probably go some way, at least, in helping him domestically.
Well, I would note that King Abdullah must take threats against his life very seriously because his grandfather and namesake was assassinated back in 1951. I believe while entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque, if I recall my history.
Your history is spot on accurate, Jim. That's right. And I mean, But these cleavages in Jordanian society, the differences with other figures in the region, other leaders in the region, do pose serious challenges to Abdullah.
Stephen, let's switch gears and move slightly west and talk about Jordan's neighbor, Israel. The trial of former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to resume next week. He was Israel's longest-serving prime minister, and he is no longer immune to criminal charges of breach of trust, accepting bribes, and fraud, precisely because he lost his post as prime minister. So what impact is Netanyahu's trial having on Israeli politics?
Israelis are obviously interested in these trials. There's actually three of them. There's case 1000, case 2000, and case 4000. Case 3000 went away because there wasn't enough evidence. But Netanyahu is not a private citizen. He is the leader of the largest opposition faction in the Knesset. And if the current government were to fall, he could once again become the prime minister. And that's why this is a very important trial. If in fact he is found guilty, there is a question as to whether he could serve as prime minister again. I don't believe that he can.
Two quick things, Stephen. Number one, the case 1000, case 2000, case 4000, those are designations of the Israeli legal system.
Right.
And that's where
right.
it comes from.
And they've actually started the proceedings with case 4000 because it includes all of the charges, fraud, breach of trust, and bribery. And it's also the case where they have the most evidence. And so they've begun that trial.
Okay. Second quick question is, do we have any sense of how long this trial will last? Is this something that's going to wrap up in a week or two? Or is this something we could be talking about a year from now?
No, this trial was supposed to begin in May. It was put off until July 19th, and it will resume then. But on July 21st, the courts in Israel go on their summer vacation. They'll come back, but there'll be a short period of time, and then the Jewish holidays will be upon us, and Israel shuts down during the period of what's called the High Holidays, the Jewish New Year, and Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, where the country shuts down almost for a month around that point. So realistically, there may be some action in the trial in between, but realistically, this trial won't get going till October, and they are complicated. There are hundreds of witnesses. Netanyahu is likely to fight this tooth and nail. So this could go on not just months, it could go on for years. So again, imagine a situation where the trial is unfolding. It's still going on. The Israeli government falls and Netanyahu makes a bid to be prime minister. He could become prime minister while the trial is ongoing.
Okay, Steve, well, let's talk about that scenario since it is a realistic one. What is the status of this coalition government in Israel? It's relatively new. My understanding is that it sort of lives up to the old saying that politics makes for strange bedfellows. There are a number of groups there that are in most instances at odds with one another. So give us a lay of the land of who's in this coalition government and how it's getting along in its first couple weeks.
Yeah, you know, in the early betting was that the coalition had done its job. It had ousted Netanyahu, and then, you know, fissures and differences amongst these parties that really don't actually fit together in any kind of coherent ideological way would bring the coalition down. But in fact, the leaders of the coalition, the Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, the now Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, they crafted coalition agreements that are more robust than in the past. So it makes it harder to bring down the government. And as you point out, it's not just Naftali Bennett who is to the right of Netanyahu and his partners, or Yair Lapid, who's, you know, people call him center or center left. I think only in the context of Israeli politics is he center or center left, but he does have differences with Naftali Bennett. But you do genuinely have the left in this coalition, as well as a Palestinian Islamist party. These are a party called the Ram Party, led by a guy named Mansour Abbas, who is a Palestinian citizen of Israel, and his party is part of the Islamist movement that exists within Israel.
I have to ask, Stephen, is he any relation to Mahmoud Abbas?
He is not any relation to Mahmoud Abbas, at least not any direct relation to Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority. And this is, you know, groundbreaking in Israeli politics. You know, never before has a coalition included, you know, as they say, a non-Zionist or anti-Zionist party. But Abbas, you know, first, he's acting like, you know, a politician. He could get resources, desperately needed resources for his constituencies among the Palestinian citizens of Israel, which, you know, have not enjoyed the same kind of benefits and resources from the state. Although I will say that Netanyahu, in the later Netanyahu period, devoted more resources to the what's called the Arab sector than previous governments. But this is, you know, the promise of going into the coalition is that you can make a deal to get resources for your community.
And just to be clear, we talk about Arab citizens of Israel. These are people living within Israel proper. We're not talking about Palestinians in the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip.
Right. I am specifically using the term Palestinian citizens of Israel. Some people use Arab citizens of Israel or Israeli Arabs. There are all
Understood.
Kinds of...
And there are controversies. issues, issues about right, the exactly. choice. And I take that point.
And so, you know, thus far, the coalition has, it hasn't been a very long time, but it has worked rather well. Yair Lapid went to Jordan, speaking of King Abdullah being in the United States, and met with his counterpart, the Jordanian foreign minister. The new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, had a secret meeting with King Abdullah. This is all part of an Israeli effort to repair its relations with Jordan. Netanyahu had not visited with King Abdullah in 5 years. That's extraordinary for neighbors that have close security ties to each other. So there was really an effort on the part of this government to repair relations with a very important neighbor, as well as take a kind of new look at the Palestinian issue. Now, I don't expect much because of this government, who its leaders are, but there is some discussion among Israeli intellectuals, and apparently Bennett is interested in this idea, which is called shrinking the conflict, so that the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians will be kind of narrowed to look at quality of life issues and economic issues for the Palestinians. Now, the Palestinians have already rejected it. This is sort of dressing up Netanyahu's economic peace proposal to the Palestinians. But nevertheless, there seems to be an effort to take, at least explicitly, the question of annexation off the table at the moment. Now, if you're Palestinian, it's hard to take that very seriously, because what we've seen is annexation by way of occupation, a creeping annexation. But nevertheless, it seems that this government is trying to lower the temperature. It's taking a very hard line on Gaza, but lower the temperature overall for Israeli politics, focus on COVID. There's been outbreaks of COVID because the Israelis, as well as they've done in vaccinating their adult population, were very slow in vaccinating their 12 to 16 year olds, and that's where the outbreaks have come. So it has defied people's expectations. The belief was that this would be totally dysfunctional. It may yet be that, but it's not. And getting back to looping back to Netanyahu, he's doing everything possible to try to undermine it.
Which he would do even if he weren't on trial. I would imagine right. if you were the leader of the largest opposition party, you would try to find ways to persuade the voters that the ruling party is the wrong people to be in charge. But if you may, Stephen, just quickly, could you tell us a little bit about what Mr. Bennett is doing to try to patch up relations with the United States? My sense was that the Biden administration gave Prime Minister Netanyahu a bit of a cold shoulder, at least early on. A lot was made of the fact that Joe Biden didn't pick up the phone on January 20th and call Bibi. So what is Naftali Bennett doing to try to restore a bit more comity in relations with the United States?
Well, actually, President Biden and Prime Minister Bennett spoke not long after the Prime Minister assumed the office. So I think the United States also wanted a signal that wanted a constructive working relationship with the new government. I think the effort to lower the temperature on issues like the West Bank, not, you know, banging the table about annexation, those kinds of things, helps with the relationship with the United States. That doesn't mean that these issues have gone away. I think also, in contrast to during the Obama years, when the United States was negotiating the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, with Iran, that was signed in 2015, Israeli government is not going to send the prime minister here to address a joint session of Congress to try to undermine the president, but privately express their concerns and views about what's happening in those negotiations. Now, that may be moot because things don't seem to be going well in those negotiations. There is a new Iranian president. He is going to replace the negotiators with the United States. And so we'll have to see how that happens. But that seems to have been the strategy there. And then, of course, Yair Lapid has said, we need to repair our relations with Washington. We can't just have relations with a wing of the Republican Party. We need to have relations with Democrats and everybody in Washington, D.C. We need to do a better job of explaining our side of things. So I think that those things will help the Israelis, at least in the short run in Washington. You know, clearly Prime Minister Netanyahu had worn out his welcome in Washington, D.C.
Well, I would say he had worn out his welcome certainly with the Democratic Party. I'm not sure he wore out his welcome with a large chunk of the Republican Party.
You'd be surprised, though, in private, how Republicans would, you know, recognize that Netanyahu could have an interesting relationship with the truth. Let's put it that way. So again, it's early. We'll see what happens. But it does look like the U.S.-Israel relationship will be at least a more normal dialogue, at least between the White House and Israeli leaders, than it has been in the past.
Even as tensions continue to buffet relations between the two capitals.
Indeed. But Jim, let's turn to an emergency Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC, meeting announced by New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern in the last week. Ardern noted in the announcement of the virtual virtual meeting that a majority of APEC leaders would be in attendance, including President Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Give us some background, Jim. What do we need to know before this emergency APEC meeting in the coming week?
Well, you're right, Stephen. This is unusual. It's a break from precedent. But first, maybe I should take a step back and explain to people what APEC is, since I suspect it's not top of the mind for most of our listeners, and we're not used to it in the same way we are talking about the EU and the like. APEC was set up as a cooperative multilateral economic and trade forum. It has 21 members, and this is the most important thing. They have members on both sides of the Pacific. So APEC includes among its members Australia, China, Japan, South Korea, and Russia, as well as the United States, Canada, Mexico, and Peru. Now, as you mentioned, the New Zealand Prime Minister Ardern, announced on Monday that there was going to be this emergency meeting and that she's going to chair it. And that's because New Zealand is set to be this year's host for the APEC meeting. So she gets to play this role. And as you mentioned also, Prime Minister Ardern said that President Biden had RSVP'd, yes. President Putin has also said he will be attending. We don't know, however, if Xi Jinping is going to be jumping on Zoom for the meeting. Now, why was it called? The rationale we have been given is that APEC leaders really need to do more and do more formally to tackle COVID and the consequences of COVID. Obviously, COVID has had a big impact on the economy. It's produced the biggest contraction in the APEC economy since the Second World War. When Prime Minister Ardern announced the meeting, I think she cited a number of 81 million jobs that had been lost.
81 million jobs among the APEC members. That's huge.
It is a huge number. And we've seen this, obviously, you know, here in the United States. And so in her statement, she said that, let me quote her here, responding collectively is vital to accelerate the economic recovery for the region. And so a big part of what they're going to be talking about are immediate measures that the countries can take to provide more coordinated regional action. I think, and also looking for steps they can take that will promote growth over the long run. Now, that's the formal agenda. As you know, Stephen, being a savvy follower of foreign policy, the countries that are coming to this meeting have a bunch of other agendas that they're going to try to work into the conversation.
So, two questions. One, what are the prospects of there being genuine cooperation and collective action among the APEC members to address the COVID problem among its members? We saw earlier this summer that President Biden and EU members had announced that they were going to donate a billion vaccines. Can we expect something out of APEC, some similar kind of thing? And then, of course, there are huge questions about the effectiveness of the Russian vaccines and the Chinese vaccines. So how does that impact cooperation? And then, of course, just the other day, there was a war of words between China and the U.S. military over the United States. A warship went through what is the United States believes to be international waters, and the Chinese says their waters. And you've got all kinds of problems there among different members of APEC, particularly on the eastern side of it. So how's this all going to work?
Well, let me take your questions in order, Stephen. The first question about what are the chances for action, I'm going to say very, very low. And I'm really not going out on a limb here because Prime Minister Ardern, when she announced the meeting, also in a way undercut it by saying that she said no major announcements should be expected from the meeting. Now, potentially, she's trying to sort of set expectations low so that she can deliver something and we can say, wow, it was a productive meeting. But at least formally or officially, what we're being told is this is not going to really move the ball. But that gets us into the issue I mentioned earlier, which is that the countries coming to this meeting, I think particularly the Biden administration, have another agenda entirely. And again, I think for Biden, there's going to be talk about, A, that the United States remains very interested in the Pacific, that it's the growth part of the world economy, that the United States intends to play a significant role. And then I suspect in a variety of ways, the president is going to indicate the need for the countries in APEC to be very concerned about the behavior of other countries that may infringe upon their economic growth. I don't think President Biden will go out of his way and single out China by name. But as you know, diplomatically, there are ways to say things where you make clear to everybody in the audience who it is you're talking about. So again, I think Biden is really going to stress, you know, the importance of a free and open Indo-Pacific. And to go to your second question, he's going to talk about U.S. efforts on global vaccine distribution. And he's going to be able to say that the United States is at the forefront of this matter. He's going to talk about what the United States has done, probably will slip in how effective the U.S. vaccines are. Again, if you look at the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, they're estimated to be somewhere in the 90% range in terms of being effective. To put that in perspective, the Chinese vaccines, there are two of them. One is known as Sinovac, the other known as Sinopharm, are about 50% and 79%. At least that's what we have been led to believe. There's some controversy over how accurate those numbers are. And again, this then gets you into complicated geopolitics. A number of countries in South America, for example, have relied on China for vaccines. And in places like Peru and Chile, I believe as well, even though they have done a fair amount of vaccination, their infection rates are going up. And again, the big wild card in all of this is with the Chinese vaccines, and I think also with the Russian vaccine, it's the question of whether they really work against the new variants, particularly the Delta variant. Early news is that the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are reasonably effective or maintain their effectiveness, but it's not so clear for the Chinese vaccines. And again, a lot's not known about the Russian vaccine known as Sputnik V. The Russians say it's 90% effective, but they haven't released all of the raw data that goes into it. And I'll note that Russia right now is dealing with a major resurgence of COVID. So there's a question about the effectiveness of the vaccine or the ability of the Russian government to be able to get the vaccine in the arms of Russian citizens. So I think that's going to be an issue. And then just to close on the third question about the China and U.S. military, I don't think that is going to feature in the APEC discussions at the forefront. But again, it's going to be running through the conversation because it's known to everybody that the Biden administration has decided that China is job number one for the United States in its foreign policy. And everybody's aware of what it is hoping to do. I don't think the president has to go out and bang the table and talk about the Chinese threat, in part because a number of the countries that are members of APEC are very worried about China because they live very close to it and worry about becoming victims of Chinese coercion. Indeed, just going back to the issue of Chile and Peru, they, I think, are very unhappy with the way the Chinese vaccine has played or performed, but they're in a situation which they really can't criticize China because, number one, China was forthcoming with the vaccines, but they're also heavily dependent on their ability to sell their main exports to China. Again, the Chinese economy is huge. It needs a lot of resources. And for many of the countries in APEC, China is their number one trading partner, not the United States.
Right. I suspect that, you know, a strong motivation for the Biden administration, for the president to attend, is to demonstrate, as you said, not just American interests, but American leadership in the Pacific. But also, as you just point out, we don't actually bring as much to the table because these countries need to trade with China. Otherwise, they've got significant economic problems and potential dislocation. I wonder, though, and just switching to the COVID thing before we move on, can you have a Chinese or Russian vaccine and then in time have the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine? Or are they now locked in to having to get third and fourth doses of Sinovac or Sinopharm? This is all unknown. There's no science on the mixing and matching of vaccines.
Stephen, as I think you know, I am a doctor, but it's a doctor of political science, not of medicine. So I take no positions on what one can or can't do in terms of mixing and matching vaccines. Obviously, for many countries, they would like to have good data, data they can have confidence in about the effectiveness, not just of Pfizer, Moderna, or Johnson & Johnson, or AstraZeneca, but the Chinese vaccines, the Russian vaccines, any other vaccines that come on. But I'll just leave you with the point that you touched on. The real challenge for the Biden administration in trying to reassert U.S. leadership, and I think part of attending APEC is really about just U.S. presence, being there, showing that you're interested in what's going on, which is why I think it's almost certain that President Xi will somehow find a way to attend the meeting, because again, it's virtual. I think it would be a major omission if he did not show up at all. But again, it's trying to figure out how to craft a policy that recognizes that many of the countries we want to move closer to us and become more involved with us have important economic relationships with China, and they're not in a position to put those in jeopardy. Now, one of the ways you could do that is by having a much more forward-leaning U.S. trade policy. And again, that was the idea behind the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which President Obama signed. President President Trump ripped up and President Biden has stayed very far away from. Though there was some talk, or has been some talk this week, that the Biden administration may try to get a digital trade agreement with the countries of the Asia Pacific. Now, some of my friends who are big on trade say, well, one of the ways to do that is to resurrect TPP, or what is now known as CPTPP, the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership. But the Biden administration doesn't seem to show any interest in doing that.
Well, it's politically, it's tough road for the Biden administration to have anything related to TPP, given what's gone before. Jim, it's time to pivot to our discussion of the audience figure of the week, which our listeners vote on and tweet to us at CFR.org. This week, Jim, our audience selected Thousands March in Cuba. Pretty extraordinary what's happening in Cuba these days. Large numbers of Cubans turning out in the streets and basically demanding the end of the communist dictatorship there.
Well, you're right, Stephen. What we're seeing is unprecedented, certainly unprecedented in the lifetimes of most of us. Now, I have to say this political crisis in Cuba has been brewing for a long time. The Cuban economy is in dire straits, and you have to begin with Cuba's failed economic model. There's a reason why countries ran away from a communist command system. Now, the sanctions that Trump reimposed, reversing many of the decisions of the Obama administration, has certainly added pressure on the Cuban economy. Then COVID hits. Now, keep in mind, tourism, not from the United States, but from Europe and Latin America, is incredibly important to the Cuban economy. It generates a big portion of its hard currency. That's the stuff that you need to be able to buy goods in the international market. Well, tourism is way down because of COVID. People can't travel. So the Cuban economy has contracted by something in the order of 11 or 12%. What that means is if your economy is contracting, you don't have hard currency. You can't go and buy goods that you need on the international exchanges. So there are shortages of food and other essential goods. Add on top a surge in COVID, and the ability of ordinary Cubans to connect via the internet, should be no surprise that protests break out. Now, I'll note that the Cuban Prime Minister, Miguel Díaz-Canel, so far has taken a very hard line. Among other things, they shut down the internet because they don't want Cubans right to be able to communicate to one another. And he's also gone to the standard card in Havana's playbook, which has been to blame the United States and say, this is not a problem that we have caused. This is a problem being fomented by those people up in Washington, D.C.
Right. And the embargo. I will point out, you know, Cuba has this, you know, sterling reputation for having a public health system. They have bungled their own vaccine. And one of the things that Cuban protesters have been demanding are vaccinations, which have not materialized. But just looping back to the Washington issue, it seems really kind of empty rhetoric at this point from the Cuban prime minister. I was talking to an old and dear friend who is a daughter of Cuban refugees, and how she reads it is Cubans are not responding to it's Washington's fault, it's the embargo's fault. They want an end to repressive government. And this kind of perfect storm of things that have happened in the last 16, 17 months have really, Cubans have experienced a really difficult time. And now they're out in the streets. I mean, it's really something that I don't think people had imagined would happen.
You're quite right, Stephen. But let me go back for a minute on the vaccine issue. I think it's important to note that the Cuban government has turned down an international effort to get vaccines to Cuba, not wanting to rely on external help. So I think that's important to note. The second thing is, in terms of what's happening on the ground now in Cuba, is what should the Biden administration do about it? How should it respond? Now, I think it's important to note that both policy and political calculations are at play. On the one hand, the Biden administration clearly wants to encourage, and if at all possible, to help the protesters. You know, of course, Biden came to the presidency saying that he wanted to put democracy at the forefront of U.S. foreign policy. Well, here is a country 90 miles off the American shoreline, which does not have democracy, and what people are demanding, as you just said, is to end the repression. They want to have a say in their own governance. But the reality is that U.S. ability to influence what happens in Cuba is limited. And I think the Biden administration also doesn't want to give Díaz-Canel evidence that he can use to delegitimate the protesters, painting them as tools of Yankee imperialism. And you're right that it seems early on that the protesters aren't blaming the United States for their position, but there's a reason why the Cuban government has gone back to this play in the playbook year after year. It's because it has worked.
Right.
Okay. Now to get to the political angle, Democrats are competitive in the state of Florida, but they lost in 2020 because Cuban Americans, but also Venezuelan and Colombian Americans, went for Donald Trump. And they did so because they see Biden and Democrats more broadly as soft on Cuba and as embracing socialism. So it's not lost on anybody in the White House that the Democrats and President Biden have a political problem in South Florida. And so this gives them a potential political opportunity. And I have no doubt that the president's getting advice, political advice, that he should be siding forcefully with the protesters. I've heard calls for him to go to South Florida to give a speech. You can imagine something with shades of Ronald Reagan going to the Berlin Wall, demanding that Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall. But again, doing something like this risks making what's happening in Cuba about us, not about them, and undercutting what very brave Cubans are doing to protest what is a repressive regime.
That's exactly the point that this old friend of mine was making in a conversation about what was going on. I just want to underline the fact that on the politics of it, of course, President Biden was the vice president of the United States when President Obama opened relations or reestablished relations with Cuba, and the president went to Cuba. Now, President Biden has made a very strong statement about the protests and the rights of Cubans and about the communist dictatorship in Cuba. So clearly there's politics, but as you said, it's a very fine line for a president to walk here because strong and stronger statements can backfire and undermine what it is that the Cubans in the streets want.
And it could also create expectations that we won't be able to deliver on. That's always a peril to these sort of things. And I will just note on President Biden that when he was candidate Biden, he was calling for restoring the relaxation in pressure on Cuba that Barack Obama had put forth and that Donald Trump reversed. And I will note that President Biden has not acted on the policy prescription that candidate Biden had. And I doubt very much they will do so now in the middle of protests when it will look as if he is giving in to the government in Havana or doing them a favor. So I don't think that's going to happen for any time.
Certainly, certainly. Well, Jim, that's our look at the world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. Muslims participate in the Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia. The World Trade Organization General Council convenes in Geneva. And the One Young World Summit takes place in Munich.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge, Francesca Aramiba, and Michael Kohler for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrera and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Stephen Cook saying goodbye.
And this is Jim Lindsay saying so long, stay well.